Welcome to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro, and this week my guest is Dr. Gaurav Khanna, a theoretical physicist from the University of Massachusetts, someone I've known for a very long time, and someone who's been using the Mac for scientific computing for a long time. Dr. Khanna, may I call you Gaurav?
Sure, John. Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you for being on the show. So, first thing I want to do is ask you to sort of introduce yourself to the listeners, and we'll get to how we got to know each other in a second. Tell us about your position and what your university and department, and tell us about your technical interests, what you're pursuing as a physicist.
Sure. So I am an associate professor at the University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth. And my interests, my department is the physics department, and my interests happen to be in the area of gravity. That's really what I do research with. And the tools of the trade, so to speak, are theory. So I'm a theoretical physicist, but of course I heavily rely on computation as well.
So how did you get into this business? I know as I was younger, I was inspired by Einstein and Feynman. Who are some of the physicists who inspired you?
So that sounds somewhat cliche for me, but for me it's always been the classic Einstein. And in fact, I remember when I was maybe in eighth grade or maybe a little younger, I was fascinated by his writings. I would read Einstein's translated writings. My father had several versions of some of his original notes and papers. And I was desperate for a while to try to understand every single equation and every single statement that was being made. Yeah. And it really led me down this path. You know, I would basically go and consult my father and say, okay, so this context of this equation, what do I need to learn? What kind of math do I need to learn? And he would say, oh, you need to go learn linear algebra for this. And I would go and embark on finding a textbook and learning the subject of linear algebra so I could follow that equation. And then, you know, a few minutes later, it would be another equation and another type of math I would have to learn. So that really kind of set my course towards what I need to become to be a theoretical physicist, you know, what I need to know to become a theoretical physicist. So, yeah.
Was your father a physicist too?
Yes, yes. He's retired now, but he was actually a particle physicist. And so he was able to really guide me through a lot of things.
Cool. Yeah, the first time you look at F mu nu, you go, oh my God,
yep,
what do
yep.
I do? I'm over my head. I need to learn these tensors.
Yes, exactly. Yes. That held me up for a very long time, the tensor algebra part, yeah.
So what would you recommend if somebody was interested in getting into this kind of research? What kind of mathematics program would you recommend?
It's a good question. So I think that you certainly need to learn as much math as possible. But I do think by accident, the approach that I took was perhaps the most motivating in the sense that you have a goal. So let's say your goal is to understand Einstein's work. So you could always go back to the original papers. They're freely available and try to follow through each and every step that he takes in his work. And based on what you would need to understand those steps, that would give you a sense of the sort of, at least the minimum amount of math you need to follow the work. And that to me was very motivating because I had an end goal in mind, which was to follow Einstein's theory. And that really sets you on a course to almost through a typical physics program, a physics, let's say, bachelor's degree program. That's exactly what we sort of seem to cover to be able to follow through those original papers of his. So it leads you down the path of effectively getting a bachelor's degree formally, but the content would be the same, yeah.
When I wrote an article about your work with the Mac Pros, I think about a year ago, I had some pictures of you with a twin Mac Pros and an Apple 27-inch Thunderbolt display, and above that was a bookshelf. Those are some really classic books.
Yeah. I still have them,
Including Misner, Thorne, and Wheeler, Gravitation. How does that book stand up after 25 or 30 years? Is it still the book?
It's still quite a classic. So I would say that even though that book was written in the 70s, because of the extensive size of that book, it still covers a lot of material that is sort of absent from others.
Mm-hmm.
It is not the book that is currently used by graduate schools for gravity. There are newer books now, in particular, when I was in grad school in the 90s, they were using this book by Bob Wald, which was sort of the classic at that time. And now there's a newer book by Sean Carroll that is very recent, written in the last decade or so, in the last few years, actually, that is sort of the book of choice for graduate programs. But honestly, if you ask me, I still keep going back to MTW, you know, for referencing things and, you know, for finding things that you often can't still find in other places. They have a lot of content in there. It's called the telephone book, you know, for good reason there. Yeah.
I really like Sean Carroll. I follow him on Twitter. I've read several of his books. What got me started on Dr. Carroll was the book called From Eternity to Here.
Mm-hmm, yeah, yep.
Great layman's book that talks to you about the evolution of the universe, cosmology, the arrow of time, and it's just terrific. Now I'm reading his book on the particle at the end of the universe, the Higgs boson.
Yep, yep. He's a great writer, absolutely.
He is. Well, so I wanted to hear more about your particular research interest. Is it related to the particular kinds of black holes or how they interact with the environment, or is it different kinds of black holes like spinning or charged or... What are you working on specifically?
Right. So my main area of research, like I said earlier, is gravity. And that naturally takes me to black holes because that's mm-hmm. the place where gravity is the strongest in the universe. In fact, it's infinite in black holes. So studying black holes as a gravitational physicist is a natural thing. So I would say that for almost two decades, that's basically been my career at this point, I've been focusing on black holes. And part of it has to do with the structure of a black hole. More recently, sort of the internal structure of a black hole is something that I'm very interested in, so it's inside the horizon. But also somewhat more astronomical aspects of black holes. In particular, I'm sure you're very well aware, John, that black holes are sort of the strong sources of gravitational radiation. And this is something that we expect to be able to see very shortly, certainly by the end of the decade.
Is that the Hawking theorem that they radiate?
So that is thermal radiation. So not mm-hmm. quite, because that's actually extremely weak and we really can't see that. I don't think we could see it, you know, for a long time. But these are essentially, so gravitational waves are things that Einstein predicted a century ago at this point. And there are these large detectors that have been built. I think the
LIGO?
Largest
is that the LIGO one in Louisiana.
Yes, exactly. It's the LIGO detector that, in fact, has just come online after an upgrade, as of a few weeks ago. And the expectation is by the end of this decade, so in the next 2 or 3 years, maybe 4 or 5 years, it's going to actually make the first detection of these waves, and they've never been seen before ever. And so the discovery of these waves is one thing, but the fact that they're going to carry information that is completely complementary to information that we have about any astrophysical object through light, because these are basically a new form of light, gravitational waves. They're just not at all, they have information that's totally different than what normally we would see from light-based astronomy. So oftentimes that's why it's referred to as opening up a brand new window onto the universe. So that's what makes sort of, another part to the study of gravity and certainly black holes very exciting is the fact that we expect to have data coming in very soon that is going to tell us so much more about these objects.
Is that going to be, I'm over my head now quickly, but is that going to be of interest in helping us understand how to merge gravity and quantum mechanics?
Probably not.
Okay.
Yeah, probably not.
Just fishing here.
Maybe if we get clever enough, one would be able to get some hints of quantum gravity once we get to the point of being able to make really precise detections and of these waves. I would probably say that we're very premature at the current stage. Right now, I think we would consider it a huge success if we're able to make the first detection of such a thing.
Sure.
But eventually, absolutely, you know, who knows? But probably not in the short term. In the short term, I think the detection challenge itself is quite enormous. And once we have the detection challenge completed, being able to harness the information in them to learn something new would be the next stage. I think that's it's going to take decades to really fully extract the potential that this window would offer us.
So why don't you tell the listeners just briefly how this LIGO works with the lasers and the compression?
Right. So basically the idea of a gravitational wave is that it's sort of considered a ripple in space-time. And what that effectively means is that if you've got, let's say, two free masses that are a wide distance apart, and if the space in between them, the space and time in between them sort of wiggle, or sort of this is what we mean, a ripple in space-time, then effectively what that means is you could think of those two masses as getting closer and further apart. But these distances that are going to move over are very tiny. I mean, to give you a sense of what the scale of that is, one talks about a strain of about 10 to the negative 20, negative 21, which means that if these masses are about a meter away, then they would basically wiggle with a distance of about 10 to the negative 20, 21 or so meters.
And we're trying to detect that with a laser.
Bouncing back and forth. Yeah, so the idea would be that you sort of do standard interferometry and you bounce a laser back and forth and you try to find a small shift in an interference pattern that would sort of pick up that particular small minute change. Now, keep in mind, we're talking about a distance that is going to be several times smaller than the nucleus of an atom that the movement is going to be, right?
Oh, my. Oh, my.
So what the trick they basically use is to put these two masses, so to speak, very far apart. So they're kilometers apart, which is the reason why LIGO is a huge detector. It's 4 kilometers long, which helps you because that compounds the effect. But even then, we're talking about being able to measure very minute distances. Again, you know, fraction of the size of a nucleus of an atom is the level of accuracy one needs. So it took a major investment by the National Science Foundation. In fact, I think this is the largest project NSF has ever undertaken. I think they're at that point now that they can do this, and hopefully the data we have soon is going to verify that.
Cool. Well, this is great stuff, and it's been of immense interest to me throughout my career. But one of the things I want to make sure we have time for is to get into how Apples and Macintoshes have kind of weaved their way into your scientific life. I remember the first time I ran across you, I was with Apple trying to promote using Macintoshes for science. And I ran across this wonderful site, hpc.sourceforge.net, because I was neck deep in the Virginia Tech supercomputer and using Macs and clusters and setting up, trying to understand InfiniBand and all these parallel processing techniques. And we were just delighted that you were working so hard to develop the F77 compilers and making sure we had all these scientific tools at SourceForge. And that, you know, that led to you today, you know, using those Mac Pros for your research. So kind of tell us about how you came to be using the Macs for your scientific computing.
Yeah, sure. So that's a fun story. So I guess since middle school and high school, I was very fond of Macs. And I would say it had to be an irrational aspect of a child, which is they were just very cute and warm looking. I mean, as compared to anything else. And I think that sort of trend is in some ways continue. I've heard of younger children who really enjoyed the look of the iMac, you know, the multicolored one. And it felt like it was welcoming and warming to them as opposed to sort of like, you know, being intimidating. So there was an element of that, I think, and I was quite attracted to Macs just by their look and their ease of use, I guess you could say. But when I went to grad school, which was in the 90s, I was quite disappointed to see that they weren't easy to use for computing, for doing scientific work. In fact, I remember the first Mac that I remember using quite extensively was one that was running OS 7 and OS 8 and OS 9. I remember those years. This is pre-OS 10 years.
Yeah, without preemptive multitasking and memory protection, it was a mess.
Exactly. And even, for example, if one needed to run a simple C code or Fortran code, it was complicated. I used to have this thing called Code Warrior. It was a commercial product. I think somebody bought it for me or whatever. And there was no Fortran support. There used to be this very elementary F2C converter you could get, I believe, from some NASA website, if I recall correctly. This is like really going back 20 years. And I was able to get some Fortran code to work. It was incredibly complicated to get anything scientific really working.
That's why we loved you so much, because it was like pulling teeth to get Apple interested in Fortran, because every manager I talked to said, Fortran? Isn't that a language from the 50s? We don't do Fortran.
Right, yes. And it's sad because there's so much legacy code that all of science relies on that is written in Fortran. And if we had ample resources, which of course we don't, you know, one would have rewritten that code into something more modern. But the fact is that science of all places certainly don't have the resources to be able to rewrite code. And so that code needs to be utilized the way it is. So So basically, it was quite a problem to get things going. And then OS X really opened an opportunity because it was based on Linux. It really made it, or Unix. It really made it far easier for me to take sort of code that ran nicely on SGI systems and Solaris systems and Linux, mm-hmm. and port them over onto Macs. And the main key piece there was to have a Fortran compiler. That was sort of the, I guess you could say, how it really got started. And you're right that it's been going back a long time, but I remember I started with an F2C converter first, and then I found a way to compile G77 and eventually G-Fortran on the Mac. This is sort of the early 2000, so early part of the century. So that's really what got me going, is sort of the strong desire to have my science applications run on the platform that I loved so dearly all my life. And it was really the coming of OS X which made it possible. It was quite a struggle before that.
And now, after all these years, you've come to OpenCL.
Yes. So OpenCL, I think, is sort of is really the Mac treading into HPC, into the waters of high-performance computing. And it's a way, those of your listeners who are unaware, it's basically a way for people to be able to make use of accelerators, in particular GPUs, for doing any kind of, for speeding up any calculation that they're doing. And I'm a huge fan of OpenCL and a huge proponent of OpenCL, because it's an open language, which means that it's not proprietary, it's not owned by anybody, and it runs on pretty much anything. You know, most vendors support it, and you can run it on Mac with, let's say, NVIDIA GPUs or ATI GPUs, whatever, and it's going to run flawlessly. So at this point, all my codes, all my research codes, and also some in my community that I've helped evangelize are sort of OpenCL enabled and take advantage of OpenCL if a platform were to offer it for higher speeds. So as of, I guess it's been about a year since we did that story about OpenCL on the Mac.
Right.
So it's been very fruitful to have invested in that.
So the thing here is that we're talking about parallel processing, and while your Mac might have two or four processors, four our cores, these powerful NVIDIA graphics chips have hundreds of cores, maybe more.
Even thousands, yeah.
Thousands,
yeah.
And if you can get them all working together with very short communication path between them, you can get all working together with OpenCL. And you have practically a supercomputer on your desktop.
Exactly, yes. I mean, effectively, on my sort of science-type applications, if you were to compare with, let's say, a serial processor and the performance one gets, a GPU on, let's say, something like the Mac Pro can give you performances that are almost 100 times faster, 50 to 100 times faster. Of course, it's highly dependent on the application and the code and all that stuff.
Sure.
But we're talking about orders of magnitude, you know, one or two orders of magnitude that can be gained fairly with somewhat of effort, but not it's not that difficult. So.
Okay. Well, I want to take a short break here for just a second and talk to our listeners for this commercial break. I want our listeners to know that there's a great way you can help support the Mac Observer and all our podcasts. Here's how you do it. When you're thinking about buying something from, say, Amazon, go instead to the Mac Observer homepage. And if you look on the right side, about halfway down, you'll see a banner that says Support TMO. And you can click on Amazon link, but you won't pay any more. It is just a little message to Amazon that says, hey, you came from the Mac Observer. And guess what? We get a small fee for bringing their business that way. And one of the things that that does is that helps the Mac Observer do all the things that we do for you to provide news and those tips and those how-tos and our podcasts and everything else at the Mac Observer. So next time you're thinking about buying something from Amazon, come to the Mac Observer first and send a little of the money our way. Okay. Thank you, Dr. Khan. Let's get back to Macs and science. So about a decade ago, Apple was really into science support because that's what you do with a Unix-based computer. But as we know, over the years, especially since the iPhone has come out, Apple has kind of, you know, lost interest. Apple.com/science no longer exists. How do you feel about Apple's continuing support for science in any case? And when is one maybe better off switching to Linux, if that's even a thing you can even think about doing?
Yeah, it's a great question, John. And I do remember the time about a decade or so when you were at Apple and you were really the primary driver, I think, for that science-based initiative. So certainly a lot of the credit goes to you there. But yes, you are right that Apple's interest in supporting science workstations, maybe even the Mac in general, especially workstation class Macs, has faded a bit. And to some extent, it's understandable because the revenue stream really is focused on these iDevices, like the iPhone in particular. So the attention is going to have to sort of shift a bit from where the revenue comes from. There's no question about it. Of course, it's disappointing, you know, to sort of see that Apple's attention towards science is not quite the same that it was. I do think there are opportunities, and maybe we can talk about them a little bit later today in the podcast, where Apple could potentially do a few things, a few fairly simple things, and even on the iDevice context, be able to find a way to engage supercomputing, high-performance scientific computing, and things of that sort. So that would be interesting as a possibility.
Let's go ahead with that because we're about that point in the show. I'm fascinated about your ideas about. Are you thinking about say something taking an A9X array and putting them into some sort of supercomputer construct?
Exactly.
If you could get a hold of them as individual chips, I don't know if you can do that.
Yeah. So let me explain a little bit. So essentially, and maybe many of your listeners may know this already, that the challenge in supercomputing today is in a way surprising. It's not that we can't build a faster machine. We can certainly build a faster machine by adding more and more processors or adding more and more compute nodes or just having a large system essentially with just so many computers that they're linked together that when they can solve any problem one would want to solve on them. So that can be done. Of course, it's a question of resources, but imagine if that wasn't an issue, one can build a large machine. The issue is that turning it on is impossible. Why? Because it may take, I don't know, like 10 nuclear power stations to turn on a machine like that. It's just going to be so power hungry that it would be extremely cost prohibitive not only to build but also to actually power it, to make it run. You may need enough, you know, power that, you know, New York City, for example, needs to turn this machine on. And that's just not a very sustainable, viable effort.
Unless you're Oak Ridge National Laboratory and you're next to the Tennessee Valley Authority and you can pull gigawatts.
Yeah, even for them, I think beyond a certain point, it may become, you know, a sort of a difficult proposition. So it's interesting that we're at a stage in technology, in computing technology, that there's another industry which is facing a similar challenge, but at a small scale. So, for example, everybody wants their iPhone to last longer. Everybody maybe would want their iPhone to last a week as opposed to a day, or their watch to last more than a day. In other words, they want their devices to deliver more performance, better video, you know, better performance.
With low power,
because they want the batteries to last longer. And Apple knows that battery technology can't really be improved very significantly. That's tough. But they certainly have a handle on the processor technology, because they build these in-house now, and they've managed to make leaps and bounds with regard to the power consumption of these. Now imagine if there was a way to open up these processors for actually supercomputer use in the exact same way, you know, which is these processors would be very, very, very efficient. They would be very high performing, but they would sip power. They would use very, very little power. And one could potentially build the next generation supercomputers of these processors alone. So that would be a context. Now, to make it more concrete, I think it actually could be very easy for Apple. So I was looking at the newest Apple TV, for example. And the Apple TV, in many ways, I think is like the ideal compute node. It's small, it's efficient, it's powerful. And now one can even program it.
But you've got to communicate with it.
You've got to communicate with it, yeah. So that's certainly one thing that would be lacking, in the sense that one would want to have a high-speed network of sorts.
Right.
But even if one sort of ignores that issue for the moment, one could say, okay, it needs to at least be programmable. And now with tvOS, one could potentially find a way to be able to make use of that technology to run code on it. And I would love to be in a position to be able to take, for example, an Apple TV and run my code on it. The communication issue, of course, is going to be another one that one would have to work towards. But I think Apple's gotten to the point that one can actually think about purchasing, let's say, a number of Apple TVs as sort of dev kits and be able to at least try to run science code on it and see how they do.
Interesting.
Yeah, so I think there's definitely the possibility of these that's emerging. Of course, I don't know if Apple would take an interest in that type of a project.
Well, you know what I was fantasizing about? My fantasy would be a concurrent, you know, 2013 Mac Pro-like platform filled full of like 50 A9s. And then all on a high speed internal bus. Do you think that could compete with the Xeon processors and OpenCL and the graphics processors, or would that be not competitive with the super graphics cards that we have stuffed in there?
No, I think it would. It would be very competitive if it could be done. I mean, that of course requires a brand new. I mean, so the angle that I'm taking here is that. The hardware that Apple's engineered, if you want to simply use it as is, that would be the easiest thing, you know, to do. Now, if Apple were to want to dedicate resources to be able to use their technology and design brand new hardware specifically for the purpose of HPC, I mean, that, of course, would be awesome.
It would.
But I guess I'm kind of, you know, I'm not as optimistic as you, perhaps, or my fantasy is somewhat
fantasy.
More limited.
Yeah,
yes. But even I think even with something like the Apple TV, something interesting could be done. It's kind of what I'm hoping. Yeah.
What do you think the Mac Pro is going? Do you have any glimmers? I mean, it's been since the summer of 2013 when it was announced, and I know you have several of them. Are they still your go-to workhorse? And where do you have any glimmers of where you think Apple could do to come out with version 2?
Yeah, I mean, so certainly that's the one I primarily sit at, and it's something that, in fact, I'm sitting at right now, and I have one at home and one here on campus. I have also noticed the same thing, which is it's been nearly 2 years, and it hasn't changed at all, while in the meantime there have been maybe at least a refresh or two on both the processor side of things and also the GPU side of things.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know why that is the case, in the sense that why Apple has been sort of delaying the release of a next generation version. Maybe it's a technical issue. I'm not quite sure. So I don't know what's really going on there. But it is a little bit worrisome because they have, I think, a beautiful platform. I have, when we talked about this last time, there were all these really nice things I say about them, and I really do think they're a great design to go forward on. But it has been lacking in terms of updates. So not sure what's up with that, honestly.
But still, with the continuing evolution of OS X, some things are being stripped out. My wife was complaining to me about GDB being stripped out and replaced with LLDB, which made it not so much fun for her students at college using, what is it? The IDE for...
Xcode?
Is that no, the other one, the public one. It's just suddenly escaped my mind. So she's having a little bit of trouble there. And of course, Java is being pulled out, and it's getting more locked down security-wise. How are you feeling about the continuing usability of, say, El Capitan and the scientific world? Can you add back and insert the things in there with success that you need?
Right. So my personal experience has really been with GCC. The sort of I still provide different versions of GCC for the Mac on my website. And
Eclipse. I can't believe I forgot it. Go ahead.
Right. Yes. So as far as GCC goes, luckily that continues to be a priority target, and it's something that, you know, very readily one can compile it, and that includes compilers for, you know, the GC Java and things of that sort, so GCJ. So you could certainly get back some of the core functionality just by having GCC installed on your Mac. One doesn't have to depend on the LLVM toolchain that Apple provides. So I think you can get some of the functionality back. But at the same time, yes, I have also noticed their move away from some things that really did make the Mac very easy for scientists to use. And in the same context, I do think that the productivity on the Mac, even for scientific folks, will still be there, will still be high, simply because it is the only platform that can run a variety of productivity apps, including right. Microsoft Office and Adobe stuff, and yet be able to run at least basic code on. I mean, it certainly is a unique platform. So I don't think that's going to change. But I think if certain things were to break going forward, and I hope Apple is not in a position that that happens, like, for example, if you would just lose GCC entirely, or if you would lose backward compatibility to some extent of sort of, open source softwares, then I think we may end up in trouble then. But hopefully that
doesn't
happen.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're about running out of time here. We've been going for almost 33 minutes, and I just want to see if there's anything else you want to include and touch bases on real quickly here. Any final thoughts?
Maybe just a quick question for you, John. So what is your thought with regard to Apple's? Do you really see Apple's interest in science fading, and is there something can be done about that?
I think the perception is that it's fading with some of the technical difficulties that you talked about and the lack of upgrade for the Mac Pro. We always worry. Sometimes Apple surprises us and delights us and, you know, gives us back something after they've really worked hard and come out with something new and great. But, you know, it's been a continuing issue ever since I started with Apple back in 2000. So it's, you know, it's 1.5 steps forward, 2 steps back, it seems. So it's up to the scientists and other people to, you know, continue to make that request of Apple and put pressure on and give them feedback on OpenCL and tell them what they're doing and kind of, you know, just kind of advertise all the success that they're having. So it's kind of a rough road, but we're getting through it, I think.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you, Dr. Khanna, for being on the show. It's been wonderful. It's been delightfully technical and geeky and nerdy, and I loved it, and I hope you all, you listeners, enjoyed it. And we will see you next time.
My pleasure.